2005. My name is Ann Peckham. I'm a volunteer with the Oral History Department at the University of Wisconsin. With me this morning is Dr. Donald R. Harkness, H-A-R-K-N-E-S-S, of the University of Wisconsin and many other places. He's been an outstanding researcher, a great teacher, and a marvelous citizen. So, Dr. Harkness, we're very happy to have you.
Well, thank you very much.
If you'd start with the beginning of your life, where you were born, and a little bit about your family.
Well, I was born at the beginning of the Depression in Mitchell, South Dakota. My parents had just returned from 10 years as missionaries in Mozambique, East Africa, and because of the Depression, the churches couldn't support so many missionaries, and my parents had lost two children in the 10 years they were in Africa, and so my mother wanted to come home. So that's how it happened that I was born in this country rather than in East Africa. I grew up in, I was born in Mitchell, South Dakota, and that's famous because of the Corn Palace, and also that's where Dakota Wesleyan University is, a university to which most of my aunts and uncles on both sides of the family attended. I lived there for about 5 years, and then we moved to a small town called Highmore, South Dakota, which is 50 miles east of Pierre, right out in the middle of the prairie. My dad was superintendent of schools there, until World War II started, and then he was recruited to go to California to be superintendent of schools at the biggest of the Japanese relocation camps, and we resided there for the entire period of World War II. After the end of World War II, my father was recruited to go to Japan to work in the education department in the civil administration of the occupation. His task was to have the Japanese textbooks rewritten and purged of propaganda and militarism and emperor worship. He went over to Tokyo in February of 1946. My mother and my second brother and I went back to South Dakota for a year, where I attended my first year of high school. My brother took his senior year, and after he graduated, mother and I went to Japan in June of 1947. And that was a very interesting period of my life. We had a very exciting time. I went to a superb school, which was the original American school in Japan, which was started back in about 1906, and the one that the Reischauers attended, and we're still big backers of that Tokyo American School, which I think now is called the American School in Japan.
Located in Tokyo.
Located in Tokyo, yes. I was very active in many things in high school, but athletics was the thing that interested me the most, and I guess I didn't have too much competition because it was a small school, but I was given the award as the most valuable athlete when I was a sophomore, and then repeated it the 3 years I was there. I had great hopes of coming home and going to coming home to play college football, and I had feelers from the University of Michigan, the University of Minnesota, and at Cal Berkeley, which is where I finally ended up matriculating. I had planned on, I graduated high school in 1950, the beginning of June, and had planned on spending the summer playing on the many beautiful golf courses in Japan during that summer, but the Korean War started in June, and so the dependents who were slated to come home were sent home immediately so that they could free up the transports for transporting troops. So I came home and spent the summer in Berkeley and then started college there. I was what they now call a walk-on in football. That was, I was not on scholarship. I had only played 8 games of high school football, and there were 120 other fellows on the freshman football team, and many of them had played 4 years of high school, and they'd even had the previous spring. A lot of people graduate in California school systems at Christmas, and then they attend the spring semester. So a lot of these players had already had 1 year of college spring football as well. So I didn't think I stood much chance of making the team, but it turned out that I caught the coach's attention because I won all the wind sprints. And I was a pretty husky fellow at that time, too. And so it ended up that I was made first-string defensive halfback on the freshman team. And that year we went to the Rose Bowl, and they took 5 of us to the Rose Bowl from the freshman team, and I had a chance to go down and run Michigan plays against the very, very outstanding team that Berkeley fielded that year. In spring, we lost that game, incidentally. We went to the Rose Bowl 3 years in a row and lost by a total of 8 points for the 3 games. But in spring practice, I was playing first string varsity. Freshmen couldn't play varsity back in those days, and so that's why I wasn't suited up for the Rose Bowl game. But I did make first string and everything. I just thought that I was walking on top of the world, and I walked into the athletic department and announced that I thought that I should receive a scholarship for my tuition. Not that tuition was a very big thing in those days. At Berkeley it was $37.50 each semester, so it was $75 a year. But they said, no, you don't understand. You're here, and scholarships are used to bring people here. And so they said, but you can get an academic scholarship because you had all A's. And so they sent me over to the other office, and I applied for financial aid and got a scholarship, which helped pay books and a little bit of spending money as well. But then that summer, I got a job. The athletic department got a bunch of us a job on a labor gang, ripping out the seats and the cement foundation of the football stadium at Cal, and it entailed a lot of heavy lifting, and I hurt my back, and they x-rayed it and found that I had what's called a spondylolisthesis with spondylolisthesis, which is a slippage forward on the vertebrae in the lumbar region, and so I was declared ineligible to play football after that.
Oh dear.
So that was a great disappointment to me, and so I did become a student trainer and travel with the freshman or the JV, sometimes the varsity team, for the remaining years that I was at Berkeley, and I enjoyed that very much. But I really came to enjoy the academic life at Berkeley, too, and I did quite well academically and got interested in research. And as a result, my interest in research resulted from the fact that I met a professor, or had a professor in endocrinology, Howard Byrne, who had a very strong research program, and I went and worked with him and took 6 units each semester of my senior year in research with him, and then worked the summer after I graduated, and then the summer after my first year of medical school back in his laboratory. I think I'll stop. Okay.
So that was the end of the football.
That was the end of the football, but it wasn't the end of the football connection, because the athletic director, I've determined that I wanted to go to Washington University School of Medicine, and that I determined that as a result of an interaction that I had with two different visiting scientists in Howard Byrne's lab, who both spoke very, very highly of the faculty at Washington University. It turns out that the director of admissions, at the medical school had been the roommate of Brutus Hamilton, who was the director of athletics at the University of California. And I had gotten to know Brutus quite well. And so Brutus arranged when this William Ballman Parker, the admissions officer for Washington University, came out to do interviews, arranged for me to take him to a football game. And the result of that interaction was that I had been offered a 4-year scholarship and admission to Washington University School of Medicine before I even applied. So being that was where I wanted to go, and I had no easy way to pay my way to medical school, of course, I jumped at that opportunity. While at Cal, I met my wife, Mary. Mary is a Nisei woman, that is a second-generation Japanese-American, meaning that her parents were born in Japan and she was the first generation born here. And she had come up from Pasadena for the last 2 years of college at Berkeley. She also was a zoology major. We were zoo majors rather than pre-med majors at Berkeley because some of the best courses were in the zoo department, and zoo majors could get into those courses, and if they were full, pre-meds couldn't. So therefore we were both zoology majors. She and I both worked for this same professor in the research laboratory, and we met sometime around Christmas of our senior year, and in February she found out that she had been admitted to Northwestern School of Medicine. And then we started dating about a month later, and I don't think, really get too serious until she got the very good news that she was also accepted at Washington University, which she accepted right away. We dated then for about 3 months and decided that we would get married before coming back to school. In those days, you not only didn't live together if you weren't married, you didn't even travel cross country together. And consequently, we made the decision to get married Got right in the car the day after the wedding, which was in Los Angeles, started driving back to Missouri via the Black Hills. We went through the Black Hills, where I'd spent a lot of time as a boy, and where my older brother and his family and my mother, who was home on medical leave from the Far East at the time, my dad wasn't there, were there, so they shared a few days of our honeymoon with us, and then we were on to St. Louis. We we went into the admissions to Mr. Parker's office to announce that we were married, and he looked at us and he said, "Well, you're not both going to go to medical school, are you?" And we, of course, shrugged our shoulders and said, "Why, yes, why not?" It turned out that students were assigned alphabetically in laboratories, and they also, at Washington University at the time, assigned had two students per cadaver. So Mary and I shared a cadaver for the whole first year of our married life. To this day, Mary insists that was the worst year of her life, and she won't tell me whether it was because of the cadaver or because she was married to me. But at any rate, we had a very, very good time in medical school, working quite hard. I increased my interest in research, and especially in biochemistry, and it's probably attributable to the fact that as professors, we had three Nobel laureates in biochemistry. Carl Corey of the Corey ester, Arthur Kornberg of DNA fame, and Paul Berg of RNA fame. And we also had, as a professor of pharmacology, Oliver Lowry, who developed many of the micro techniques that are used in enzymology, fluorescent measurements, and so forth. So I took every opportunity that I had while I was in medical school to set aside time for research. Back in those days, we had the summers off between our freshman and sophomore year, and we didn't start school right after the end of the sophomore year, but had the summer off, and then we had the summers off between our junior and senior year. So I was able to rearrange my schedule to have 6 months together, during which time I did research in hematology with Bill Harrington, about whom you'll hear more. He was the head of the section of hematology there at Washington University. That is to say, I had arranged 6 months of research, but I began having back difficulties while I was on that research stint, and it was decided that I should have back surgery with a dorsolateral fusion. And so I had that done. The surgeon that was to do it was the chairman of the orthopedic surgery department, and he came in with a temperature of 105 with an FUO the morning I was supposed to be operated on. So a Dr. McCarroll went ahead and operated, and he at that time was president of the American Society of Orthopedic Surgeons, so I could not complain about that. My only complaint was that the chairman of the department got people up immediately after surgery, but Dr. McCarroll kept people in bed flat for 6 weeks. So I spent 6 weeks of my 6 months in bed. During that time, I did Max Wintrobe's book on hematology, a very famous textbook, one of the last textbooks written by one person instead of a multitude of authors. had just come out with the new edition, and so I managed to set up a stand so that I could read, and I read the entire book during that 6 weeks that I was lying flat on my back. After we graduated from medical school, I was interested, I guess, I better go back. I was interested in hematology, probably because hematology was one of the strongest sections of the Department of Medicine at the time at Washington University, but also because it was the field, maybe other than endocrinology, which opened up to biochemical research earlier than any other subspecialty area of medicine, and that was obviously because it was possible to get samples of blood to work on. And the head of hematology was a very, very bright young man by the name of Bill Harrington, who in whose lab I, as I mentioned, I worked for several months. He was the person that first demonstrated that idiopathic thrombocytopenic purpura was an autoimmune disease, and he did so in a rather cowboyish manner. He took plasma from a patient with ITP himself, and his platelet count went from 300,000 down to zero in a matter of minutes after the infusion was completed, and he became purpuric, and it was not the type of experiment that we advise people to do, but it was common amongst the investigators at Washington University in hematology at that time. The chairman at the time was Carl Moore. He was, I look on as one of my greatest mentors, although I never did research directly with him, but I did stay as a house officer for 2 years there, so I worked quite closely with him in that capacity. But he was the one that described the mechanism behind cocktail purpura. And if you might know, cocktail purpura is purpura that develops after having a gin and tonic. And he took the plasma from a patient who had cocktail purpura and then took some tonic water. And of course, it turns out the mechanism is an antibody to quinine, and that the antibody antigen affixes to the surface of the red cell, sensitizes the red cell, and causes a hemolytic anemia. And so, as I say, this type of research was sort of the thing to do in that time. And later I may have an opportunity even mention one of the experiments that I did that was rather similar to those.
In other words, these researchers were trying out these things on themselves?
Exactly. You couldn't use a medical student, of course, although as a medical student I did take a few things when I was in hematology that we wouldn't today, but hematologists got in. Some of the most exciting work in hematology that was going on about the time we were in medical school was the work on the hemolytic anemia that occurred in blacks who were coming home from Korea taking medication for malaria. And it turned out that the mechanism of that, of course, was an enzyme deficiency in the red blood cell, glucose-6-phosphate dehydrogenase. And it was that hemolytic anemia, that hemolytic process, that brought light to this population of people with oxidizing drugs. And all of those experiments on that were done by hematologists in the prison system in the university, from the University of Illinois in the Illinois prison system. And of course, we don't do those types of experiments on incarcerated individuals anymore, just like we don't on medical students anymore.
May I make a note here for anyone who's trying to write this down? If you want to know how to spell thrombotic thrombocytopenic purpura, it's the next to the last item on page 8 in Dr. Harkness's.
Is
that a different thing?
That's a different illness.
Oh, all right.
It's idiopathic, IDIOPATHIC, thrombocytopenic, THROMBOCYTOPENIC, purpura, PURPURA.
Thank you.
That's a different disease than the other one.
I feel sorry for these people who were trying to.
Well, we're now up to 1958 was when we graduated. Back in those days, it was before the match, and one was really beholden frequently to the good graces and efforts of the departmental chairman as to where one ended up doing one's residency. With my interest in hematology my class standing, I ended up actually graduating first in my class there. So the chairman, Carl Moore, kept me there on the ward service in medicine at Washington University, and an affiliated hospital down the block, a very fine hospital, a Jewish hospital, was where Mary did her internship. So we stayed on in St. Louis for 2 years of house staff training, which was all of the clinical training that I ever had. Mary did an internship, and then she delivered our first daughter at the end of, right after the internship was over, and then she worked part-time for the city public health department for the rest of that year until we left for Bethesda, Maryland. Well, how did it happen that we went to Bethesda? Well, that's another interesting, fortuitous story. I had heard from the draft board that, well, I had applied for the Public Health Service wanting to go to the NIH, and Carl Moore had put me in touch with DeWitt Stetton, who was the head of one of the large branches in the Arthritis Institute there. And I went for interviews there, and I was offered a position as one of 10 people starting a new program that was to start the next year called the Research Associate Program. And so I got accepted there, and then they said that the draft board decided that they were going to draft me into the military, and I went back to the Public Health Service, and they said, well, if you'll sign a waiver with your back, we will give you a commission in the Public Health Service. And of course, that commission in the Public Health Service took the place of the military service. And so I spent the next 4 years, actually, two required and two extra years, doing biochemical research at NIH, and Mary did her residency in pediatrics at Children's Hospital in D.C. And more about the research at NIH in a moment. got to Bethesda. Of course, the military moved us, and we had other friends who were going to the for residency in Baltimore and in Washington, and so we managed to get their things moved by the largesse of the government on our moving bill. But we moved into a home that was very close to NIH, and Mary then commuted, and we had a housekeeper who would came from the other side of Washington, D.C., all the way out to Bethesda by bus, getting there by 7:30 at least in the morning and working until the evening. And, of course, Mary had night call every third night and every third weekend. And so I worked at NIH in the lab and was home on weekends, and it worked very, very well. It worked especially well because it was the first time that we had ever received a salary sufficient to live on. When I was a resident, I received $35 a month, and as an intern and as a second-year resident, I received $50 a month. So it was nice to receive the officer's pay at NIH, and also the PX privileges, which we had. When we got to NIH, the research associate program, as I said, was only just starting. We were the first class. So they organized basic science lectures for 6 months, and we took some calculus, we took some organic chemistry, we had some biochemistry and protein chemistry from Chris Anfinson. And that lasted, I think we did 3 half-days a week for about the first 6 months. And then we had the option of going around and visiting different laboratories until we found a laboratory that we thought we'd like to work in, and one that was willing to take us. I ended up lining up a gem of a position with Leon Heppel. Leon Heppel was a nucleotide chemist and biochemist who had learned his nucleotide chemistry from Todd and the other person in London. He'd been over to learn, and he came back as an expert in this area. He was a very unusual, a fine teacher, but also a wonderful mentor. He never won a Nobel Prize himself. However, he was intimately involved with three. He identified the precipitate with the radioactivity in it that Severo Ochoa had in his test tubes with his polynucleotide phosphorylase experiments. He received a sample of a nucleotide from two different laboratories, one of them being Sutherland, and I've forgotten from whom he received the other sample, to identify, and it turned out that it was cyclic 3,5-AMP, and that Sutherland received the Nobel Prize for that. And then he synthesized the polyuridylic acid, which was used by Marshall Nirenberg to make polyphenylalanine in the first experiments showing how coding worked for protein synthesis. And then he proceeded to teach the Nuremberg laboratory how to make nucleotide triplets so that the code could actually be worked out for every amino acid. So although he himself never got the credit, he was an editor of JBC and a very, very outstanding scientist. So I spent 2 years in that laboratory working with him, and we had an active lab and also an active seminar series, journal club, a couple days a week, and people like Maxine Singer and Bruce Ames, Bill Jacoby, Herb and Celia Tabor, and others, the Weisberg brothers, all came to that particular journal club, and so we had access to some very, very good minds in that opportunity. So I spent 2 years there, which was the required period of time to be in the service, and then I decided that I wanted to have a little different experience, and I went to probably one of the other, if not the best, one of the very best laboratories on the NIH campus in the Heart Institute with Earl Statman, and I worked there for 2 years and had really an outstanding experience there also. At the end of my 4 years of at NIH, I knew at that time that I was going to go on to an academic career, largely doing biochemistry, but I still hadn't had any training in hematology. So I was offered the job, which was kind of the plum job in the Department of Medicine, as the fellow on ward hematology at Washington University, and was planning to go back there to take that. Remember, Bill Harrington at that time was the head of the section of hematology, but then he was recruited as chairman of the Department of Medicine at the University of Miami. And so he came to Bethesda and talked me into the fact that I could learn hematology on the job, and why not join him on the faculty in Miami. So I was one of the first two or three persons that he recruited to go down to that department when he took over the chair. So we went then from Bethesda, not back to St. Louis, but down to Miami, where we spent 16 years. I had, while we were in Bethesda, Mary had two more children, so now we, our family numbered five, and so we moved to Miami. And she went into practice on Miami Beach with another pediatrician, and I spent my time largely doing some clinical hematology, but predominantly setting up a biochemistry laboratory. And I had no mentors at that point. I was more or less on my own. Going was a little slow at first, but then things picked up, and had a very good experience. Back in those days, it was possible, when NIH was just revving up to support basic research, it was possible to get good research training at NIH, for instance, and then one could really go almost anywhere they wanted in terms of a faculty position, because one could get research support that would pay for one's salary and one's equipment and supplies so that one could really pretty well go where he or she pleased in those days. And I was never sorry that I picked going to Miami, because it was a very young medical school, and it was developing, and it developed very rapidly into a very strong school under the leadership of the of the dean and the Department of Medicine in particular really thrived during the years that I had the privilege to be there. Shortly after coming to Miami, we moved there in 1964. I think it was probably in 1966, the Tuskegee experiments came to light, and the NIH, after hearings in Congress, the NIH mandated that medical schools develop human studies committees and consent forms and so forth. However, they didn't give any directions as to how to do this, and so people on committees around at 120 different medical schools started meeting to decide how they were going to set up the guidelines for human investigation, and I was assigned or asked to serve on that committee at the University of Miami. And we really worked hard on it. I don't even recall any of the details about what we worked out, but after a period of about 3 years and all of these plans having been sent from all of the medical schools into NIH for approval, the NIH then came out with guidelines so that there was some uniformity thereafter around the country. But I thought that although I myself at that time had not been involved in much human investigation myself, it was an interesting experience to serve in that capacity. Subsequently, I did do a fair amount of human investigation, and I had a fairly sizable center grant for sickle cell, studying sickle cell diseases, and we had some pretty large clinical studies on that, but I won't go into any details on those. I became the head. Well, they built a new veterans hospital that moved from Coral Gables over into Miami, right next to Jackson Memorial Hospital and the medical school, and I was made chief of hematology at this veterans hospital, which had wonderful research facilities and wonderful animal facilities and so forth. So I then had my research funded over the next 14 years by both the Veterans Hospital and or the Veterans Hospital System, Veterans Administration, and the NIH. Whereas most of my research was biochemical in nature, the major area of emphasis was on the physiology of the red blood cell and the synthesis and degradation regulation of the allosteric modifier 2,3-DPG for hemoglobin. And that had some clinical implications. We also got into a large amount of comparative physiology and comparative biochemistry, looking at this system and regulation of hemoglobin in many different species. And that research was a lot of fun, and we enjoyed it a lot, and a lot of students had an opportunity to participate in it, but it wasn't of any great consequence in terms of medicine.
You mentioned a fascinating combination of creatures that you did this work on.
We I guess probably the first animal that we had opportunity to study was the dolphin. But then, because people in anesthesiology were doing some studies with the dolphin, but then we got into turtles and birds and the ostrich and probably a whole lot more than it. Well, certainly the goat was an important part of some of the studies that we did.
These were all housed in the VA facility?
Well, we got the blood, the ostrich blood we got from an ostrich farm in South Africa. And we also got eggs, ostrich eggs from them. And it turns out that the modifier for hemoglobin function is totally different in birds than it is in mammals. And it's inositol pentaphosphate in birds. And so we started studying birds because we wanted to learn about the development of it. And we made the rather startling discovery, which nobody really understands to this date, but birds, we started looking at the embryo and going back in age in the embryo, and about 5 days before hatch, the bird red cells in the embryo develop a very high level of 2,3-DPG, which is what is present in mammalian red blood cells. It regulates hemoglobin. But then as soon as they hatch, the red cells lose their 2,3-DPG and start synthesizing this other compound, which in adult life and after hatching is what regulates the hemoglobin, and that's the inositol pentaphosphate. Well, we had the opportunity to study some ostrich eggs, and it turned out that the ostrich doesn't form inositol pentaphosphate, but lacks the enzyme that puts the fifth phosphate on, so that its allosteric modifier, the one that builds up in the red blood cell, is inositol tetraphosphate. And it turns out this is the same compound that was discovered to be an important signaler in cell division, and we had this material in large milligram quantities, which we were able to send to people who were studying the more intricate details of the function of inositol tetraphosphate. We don't take any credit for any of those studies, but we at least did have the compound that they were able to use. So yes, we did use a lot of different animals, but again, as I say, a lot of that is of no great consequence to medicine.
I suppose pretty interesting, though.
Yeah, it was very interesting, and I suppose it helped with promotions, I guess I probably became a professor maybe 7 or 8 years, a full professor after I got to Miami, and was actually when Bill Harrington, after 14 years, was asked to step down as chairman of medicine, and they had an external search for chairman of medicine, and they couldn't find anybody, and so then they extended it to an internal search, and I was chosen to be his successor as chairman of medicine at the University of Miami. And I negotiated for about, and this was a big surprise because Bill Harrington was my mentor and the dean, and he had a big fight. And so the fact that the dean would accept the recommendation of the search committee that I be Bill's successor was quite suspect by most of us. I negotiated with the dean for about 6 weeks, and finally one morning walked in, I had to wait for about 45 minutes to see him that day, and I don't know whether that was on purpose or not, but as he walked in, he said, well, I've decided that I don't want you to be chairman of medicine. And I told him that, well, that was a disappointment to me, but I said, how are you going to tell the faculty? And he said, oh, I don't know. I suppose I'll write them a letter. Well, he didn't do it very well, and he ended up losing his job as dean. But in the meantime, when you get on the circuit and your name is out there as a potential chair, which I had never considered myself going into administration, but you start getting letters from other institutions. And so I had an opportunity to look several places, and including Davis and Arkansas. And then when I got the opportunity to come to Wisconsin, that really interested me. And and really what interested me the most about Wisconsin, because I didn't know that much about this campus, but I knew of its strength in biochemical research. Actually, I'll come back to this, but one little anecdote that I didn't mention earlier was that I had been on the campus at the University of Wisconsin back in 62. I had, when I was working in Heppel's lab, I had something I wanted to do with transfer RNA, and he was a good friend of Gobind Khurana's, who was at the Enzyme Institute here at Wisconsin at the time, and who subsequently went to MIT and received the Nobel Prize for being the first person to chemically synthesize a virus that was infective. But so I came out to his lab and spent 10 days in Madison working very hard to synthesize this or to alter this transfer RNA so I could do the experiment that I wanted. And I did spend time in the Enzyme Institute, but I think most of the time I must have been in the laboratory, because I was here in the summer, actually it was June, and I didn't remember that the campus was on a lake. I went between the Y and the lab and back, and I went out to the Karana's house for dinner one evening, but that I just didn't remember that there were lakes here at the time. So
that's the selling point.
That's right. Well, of course, I when they recruited me to come as medicine, they put me up at the Edgewater Hotel. So then, I was very well aware of the lake at that time. Now, where was I?
How did you decide to come?
So, I decided to come really because I was very interested in fostering research, and I felt that research to be really on the cutting edge in clinical departments had to be there had to be a connection with basic research and basic researchers on campus. And at Miami, the undergraduate campus was 10 miles from the medical campus, and so there was no interaction whatsoever between the basic sciences out there and the medical school. So I was really attracted to the fact that the medical school was right in the center of the main part of biological research on the campus at Wisconsin. And I knew from my interest in biochemistry, I knew of the really great strength of in biochemistry and enzymology here at Wisconsin. So that was really why I came, plus the fact that it was a very good offer, and I set up a laboratory thinking that and brought along one of my biochemist colleagues to run the laboratory. And when I came here and realized after I was here in the job as chair of medicine, there was a lot to be done. that I wasn't going to get into the lab very much. And so after about 2 years, my colleague went back to the University of Miami, and I closed my research and became a full-time administrator and teacher at that point.
And Mary came?
And Mary came. At first, there was some talk of the possibility that she would take an appointment at the medical school, but that really wasn't her interest, and ended up that on the search committee that selected me, was an internist. I'm sorry, the name of the internist from town who was on the search committee was Bill Rock. And Bill said that he would like to have the opportunity to find a job for Mary. And so Mary went to work with the East Madison Clinic. And at that time, I think she actually started out in the clinic in Sun Prairie. And so Mary didn't work for about the first 8 or 10 months after we got here, but then she's worked ever since that time. We, while we were in Miami, going to go back for just a moment, I mentioned that we had 4 children, and Mary was in pediatrics, and I was in research, which required going back to the lab a lot to run columns and so forth. We had the great fortune, good fortune, to have an in-house, a live-in housekeeper who did the cooking and took care of the kids, and she was a marvelous person. She was with us for 14 years, and then the kids grew up, and all of them were into college at the time we moved to, 3 of them were in college at the time we moved to Madison, and that was a bit of a problem because at the University of Miami, the tuition was paid no matter where the kids went, up to the cost of tuition at the University of Miami. Miami, being a private school, had a high tuition, and so I had one daughter at Swanee, a daughter at the University of Virginia, and a son at Johns Hopkins University. Well, when I was offered the job here, I got the offer of the salary from the dean, and it turned out that I wasn't going to be able to pay the tuition for the kids on the salary that I was offered, and so I called back the dean, that's a very good friend, Bud Brown, Arnold Brown at that time, told him that I just didn't think I was going to be able to come, and explained why it was. And he said, oh, that's no problem, you can get the rest of that money from your practice plan. And I didn't really understand anything about what that meant at that time, and so I went ahead and was recruited to come here, and I think I arrived here in October 1st. Mary came up because we did have one child who had to start school. She came up the beginning of September and bought a house and moved in right near West High. And so I arrived in October 1st, and so I'd only been here about 2 months when year-end distribution of the practice plan monies came up, and I explained to the committee that the dean had said that they would be able to take care of this. And I remember how panicked I was because they had never heard anything about this, and they went into the study, and I could see them across. The study had windows, my office had windows across above the medical library, at the hospital, and I could see them over there, and they were there for a good 2 hours with a discussion before they came back and said that yes, that they could make good on that.
I think we're running out of tape now. This will be continued. And we are now at the University of Wisconsin. It's about 1980.
About 1980, yes, fall of 1980. I think I could say at this point that I had the privilege, in quotes, privileges, I think, of being the first person who was ever recruited from outside to chair the Department of Medicine. And the Department of Medicine was quite inward-looking and inbred, and it gave me the opportunity, although I didn't have many positions initially, gave me the opportunity to start recruiting from outside, which I did as vigorously as I could. One of the first problems that I had to solve, if you will, when I came was an insufficient number of positions at the VA. One of the very talented young men at the VA had obtained a 5-year funded position so that he was outside of the VA payroll, and when his 5 years came up, he then had no job back at the VA, and right at that time I came. And I certainly want this person that we're speaking about was Dr. Jeff Jones, a very talented investigator and fine infectious disease clinician. I certainly wanted to be able to keep him, and so I made the bold recommendation. It wasn't bold for me, but it was bold for this institution to fund part-time physicians at the VA and have them part-time faculty at the medical school, paid by the medical school, and part-time paid by the VA. This was the model of many university VA hospitals, and certainly of neighboring Iowa and not so much Minnesota, but certainly Iowa. And it was the model that we had developed, Bill Harrington had developed very vigorously at the University of Miami, to the benefit of both the medical school and the Veterans Hospital. So I introduced, if you will, in medicine part-time appointments in the VA, and that enabled persons in the VA to go ahead and apply for external grants through the through NIH, but also to apply for internal grants through the Veterans Administration, and that has been a model which we have developed quite vigorously. Up to that time, and perhaps because of it, there was a real competition in the Department of Medicine between faculty members who were at the Veterans Hospital and the faculty members who were at the University Hospital, and very little interaction between the two. It was just as if the VA hospital was a hospital in another town, or a private hospital with no particular affiliation. That wasn't true in all departments, but it certainly was in medicine. So we broke that up right away, and I think to the benefit of both institutions. Probably the reason that I was able to come up with that solution so quickly and so obviously was because of the experience at Miami, but I was also very, having been part-time university, part-time VA while I was in Miami, I had become very familiar with my with the VA central office, and I was the had been the hematology program specialist for the central office in VA, and so I was quite familiar with the research funding and so forth of the VA. And one of the things that I had hoped that might follow on this, that we might even be able to develop joint clinical laboratories between the VA hospital and the university hospital, but that I won't go there anymore because those two departments have not wanted to get together. I had always envisioned a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week laboratory joint between the VA and the university hospital. After all, with the physical attachment of the two hospitals here in Madison, seemed like a very good way to go. I had the opportunity to do a lot of recruiting. I remained as chair for 14 years, and during that time we developed two new sections, section of emergency medicine. We had no full-time emergency medicine people staffing our emergency room. Shortly after I came, I recruited one of our critical care fellows to run the emergency room, Jeff Grossman, who later became chair of the Department of Medicine and is now head of the Medical Foundation. And so he oversaw the residents in the emergency room, but clearly there was need to have full-time trained people. So we developed a full section of people for the emergency room, and that section is part of the Department of Medicine. We also made some changes very soon after I came in the TLC and the governance of the TLC, and
trauma and life support.
Trauma and life support unit. It was the critical care unit, if you will, of the hospital for trauma, and we made some changes there and hired some new people to help staff that. We developed a section of geriatrics as that field matured around the country, and today we have a very fine program in geriatrics. That was significantly, that job was made significantly easier because of the Mature Institute on Aging, the interdepartmental organization that focuses on geriatric and aging problems in across campus. And so we, as a matter of fact, the person that we made head of geriatrics was head of the Institute on Aging before he left.
And this was? Oh dear.
Bill Ursler, excuse me. Bill Ursler, who was a hematologist who we had recruited to come out from the University of Vermont. And then he had an interest in geriatrics, and there were no people who were trained in geriatrics at that time. And so he became the head of geriatrics, recruited, and set up a fellowship program. And we received a lot of funding in geriatrics, and still do through the Veterans Hospital, and then on campus through the Institute on Aging. Cardiology required quite a lot of attention early on, and it was not one of it was a priority of mine, but cardiologists come at a pretty high price tag, so it took a while to put together a package, but I went to the Chancellor Shane, and he helped put together a package. He came in with probably $500,000 at least. I went to the graduate school and got some money. I went to various places. I think we were able to put together a package of about $2.5 million, which was a lot of money in those days, being, it was about 1981 or 82. And we recruited Jim Lidke from Pittsburgh to come, and Penn State, I'm sorry, and he came bringing his research team with him, and with those research dollars that we, with which we got them started, he developed a very fine laboratory over at the old hospital, and recruited a number of cardiologists and strengthened the program in cardiology immensely. We, about that time, the field of nuclear medicine was developing in nuclear cardiology, and I recruited a physician who had been with me at Miami. His name was Woody Bezosi, and he was in nuclear medicine at the University of Michigan. He was kind of on loan from the University of Miami at that time, and I had known him as a medical student. And so we recruited him to come to Wisconsin, and he established a really first-class laboratory of nuclear cardiology. We already had some nuclear cardiology through the Department of Radiology, and we ended up, because there was a turf battle as to who should have that laboratory, we ended up running it as a joint section between the Department of Radiology and the Department of Cardiology. Nevertheless, a very, very fine addition to the capabilities that we had, diagnostic capabilities we had at University Hospital. In one of the things that was of note in terms of the history of this period of the medical school and the Department of Medicine was occurred in 1983 when the state mandated that all state employees must be offered an option of joining an HMO. There had been, for a number of years, one freestanding small HMO group health cooperative here in Madison, but nobody else had so none of us at the medical school had practically heard of HMOs, although it was much in the news at that time around the country. And because of the double-digit inflation in the cost of health insurance, of course, the state hoped that they would be able to rein in these escalating costs by mandating the option of an HMO. And so we quickly studied up on an HMO and how HMOs worked, and developed a committee that actually developed the original UCARE HMO. And I chaired that committee for much of that time, and there was a very steep learning curve about the economics of medicine and managed care and so forth that all of us had during those years. But we managed within 4 months to put together UCARE, We had some internal strife within the medical school because the amount of remuneration that we could give to some of the subspecialists was not what they could get from private insurance and from fee-for-service payees. But we managed to gain everyone's cooperation and had a successful inauguration of UCARE, which has subsequently grown into what we now know as Unity Healthcare. And I don't know what the number of enrollees is today, but it has certainly been a very large part of the development of the clinical services at the university hospital. And the reason, of course, that academicians such as myself are interested in that is because that's where we train medical students and that's where we train our residents and fellows. And certainly everybody is aware that the University of Wisconsin Hospital and Clinics is rated as one of the premier teaching hospitals in the country.